Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 22nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's read the weather forecast for today, this coming from KCRG-TV. No weather worries for local or regional Thanksgiving travel. It's pretty simple. Weather won't be an issue for travel for at least several more days, just in time for when many people hit the road for the holiday. That includes today, when many folks will be hitting the road after their work and school day. Conditions start off this morning on the cold side of things, with air temperatures in the 20s and wind chills as low as the mid-10s for some. This will bounce back fairly decently as we go through the day, propelled by a decent amount of sunshine with intermittent patches of mid to high level clouds. Southwesterly breezes also help the case, with highs reaching the mid to upper 40s. A cold front moves through the state tonight, but it will have a lack of moisture to work with. Its most noticeable effect will be a gradual shift in wind direction, turning northerly by morning of Thanksgiving. Temperatures start in the upper 20s to around 30 for the holiday, but will only make it to the upper 30s to mid 40s, thanks to some cooler air moving in on those northerly breezes. Clouds gradually build throughout the day, leading to mostly cloudy conditions by the nighttime hours. The influx of cooler air continues into Black Friday, with highs below normal by then in the low to mid 30s. Clouds will also be a common sight, playing a factor into limiting the potential for significant warming during the day. Similarly, though, it will limit our lows from falling too far, with overnight readings in the low to mid 40s. Notice that there has been no mention of precipitation through this point, which is great news for travelers. There should be few to no weather-related hurdles to travel over the road or through the air for areas around the state or even the region. The closest unsettled weather through Saturday will be toward the Rockies and Western Plains, where some snow is possible. This same storm system will be heading to the east by late in the weekend, giving us a shot at some light snow by Saturday night into parts of Sunday. While amounts with this system appear likely to stay light, there is the opportunity for some slick roadways as the snow is falling. If you were planning on traveling locally on Sunday morning, pay attention to updates to the forecast and think about potential adjustments to your plans that you may need to make. With highs still reaching above freezing during the day, any slick conditions should tend to improve as the day goes on. As you head back to work and school following the long weekend, things should still be fairly cold. Lows will be in the 10s with highs in the mid-30s to around 40 each day. No major storm systems appear likely to affect the area during this time either. Now let's turn to the front page of the Courier. The lead story is titled Gratitude and Turkey Gravy. 42nd Annual Viridian Thanksgiving Dinner feeds hundreds for free. Andy Malone wrote this story, which begins with a photograph of Heather Thien, Human Resources Manager at Viridian, and she's handing 5 Thanksgiving meals through a car window in the UAW Hall parking lot on Monday. The dateline, Waterloo. Viridian Credit Union employees spent Monday assembling hot Thanksgiving meals for those who otherwise may have gone without. It's the 42nd time the annual Mike and Leona Adams Thanksgiving dinner was served. The meal is now pickup and delivery only after COVID-19 brought an end to the communal meals once served at the UAW Local 838 Hall on Washington Street. Quote, "It's the most wonderful time of the year, and this is a way we can make sure everybody can enjoy it with their family," said Renee Christopher, Viridian president and CEO. She was the lead on one of 2 assembly lines using tongs to pick up and place turkey inside styrofoam containers. Organizers changed the format for the sake of efficiency, realizing a greater impact could be made by reaching those who can't make it to the hall. Approximately 1,300 meals were served Monday in what's become the Cedar Valley's largest free Thanksgiving meal. Quote, "The need hasn't gone away. It fluctuates each year, but we're still serving hundreds of people, and it might not even be a financial need. Some are just getting elderly, and it's a big meal for people to have to put together on their own," said Julie Gage, a public relations strategist who's in her 25th year coordinating the dinner, now head of the operation. Quote, "If we can help a husband and wife who can come to us for Thanksgiving instead of having to put this together on their own, that even fulfills a need they might not be able to get fulfilled somewhere else," Gage said. The hot food is prepared by Hy-Vee, another change over years past when food was cooked on site. Volunteers over several hours assemble full turkey dinners, turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, corn, gravy, a roll, and pumpkin pie for people and their loved ones. This year, Veridian employees ran meals outside to cars trickling into the parking lot. Diners presented orange-colored pieces of paper designating the number of meals they had reserved. Volunteers handed plastic bags full of food through car windows or placed them on a seat or in a trunk. Recipients also often got a cheery Thanksgiving salutation. Quote, "It feels good to be able to help people out during the holidays," Gage said. "You never know what somebody's story is and what they're going through, and if we can make their day a little bit easier and their holiday a little bit brighter by just providing them a traditional Thanksgiving meal, then we're happy to do that." Another Veridian assembly line puts meals together and help deliver them to homes via Metropolitan Transit buses. Others assisted with Meals on Wheels, also putting together Thanksgiving meals on their own. Monday's recipients requested the meals over a period of about 2 weeks, based on how quickly reservations filled up. Quote, "It's just us," said Judy Duff, who was in her car with her husband, Larry Duff, "and we've never done this before. This way we don't have to worry about having a big turkey and all those leftovers for us, just the two of us." That sentiment was echoed by others. Ruthie Menard and her caregiver, Roger Menard, picked up meals this year after dining in on previous years. Quote, "This is a good idea for those who can't travel," said Ruthie Menard. "It's hard for me to cook nowadays, too." Another benefactor, Eugene Holmes, was picking up a meal for himself now that his wife, Darlene, is living in a nursing home. He said he used to work with Mike Adams, who, along with Mike's wife, Leona, was responsible for starting the holiday tradition as a board member for what is now Veridian Credit Union and a member of the UAW Local 838. The event is now named after the couple who brought both organizations together to help the inaugural free community meal in November of 1982 to help those struggling through difficult economic times. Quote, "It's just me, and she didn't teach me how to cook," Holmes said with a chuckle. Among those outside as the sun went down were Veridian employees Seth Conan, Heather Thien, Courtney Jewell, and Justice McLemore, who echoed sentiments about how they were there for a good cause, how it's fun to give back, and see how grateful people are for their time. Quote, "It's also good to Veridian co-workers you may not get to see and spend some time with them," said McLemore. Waterloo Schools announces proposed high school merger, $165 million new building. Story written by Angela Sturm McLaughlin, and the dateline is Waterloo. The Waterloo Community School District is poised to embark on a project that could result in merging its two high schools under one newly constructed roof. Based on a unanimous recommendation from the district's High School Task Force, Superintendent Jared Smith is requesting that the Board of Education approve hiring Envision Architecture of Waterloo to facilitate an in-depth exploration of the options concerning both programmatic, and faculty needs for its high schools. This could lead to the construction of a new building with an estimated price tag of $165 million for grades 10 through 12 on the campus of Central Middle School and the Waterloo Career Center, located on Katoski Drive. Quote, "We're going to use the 1% sales tax revenue to pay for this project," Smith said in an interview Monday. "There's no need for a bond referendum vote, which is huge. As a result, the project can move forward without a property tax increase by the district bonding against its 1% sales tax revenues of about $13 million annually over the next decade. Quote, "I'm very excited that we are proactively addressing future enrollment, faculty updates and maintenance, and program equity within the district," board member Stacy Mills said when contacted by the Courier. Quote, "We are gathering this information in order to make the best decisions as we move forward for Waterloo School's kids, staff, families, and community," unquote. A high school task force has existed since 2012, but the new committee organized in 2022 has since evaluated plans to best position the district to meet the needs of future generations of high school students. The group, made up of district officials, administrators, principals, and architects, has held numerous meetings and workshops on the topic. Through these discussions, the task force identified transitioning to a single high school as the preferred choice to best meet the needs of Waterloo's secondary students. According to a news release, the group believes this solution will provide more academic opportunities for all students, increase competitiveness in areas like career readiness, extracurricular activities, and teacher recruitment, and create operational efficiencies through modernized facilities, streamlined operations, and sustainable infrastructure. Quote, "While there are many details associated with this project that will require further discussion, we believe this could be a major turning point in the history of the Waterloo schools," Smith said. "We have an opportunity to build the premier high school in the state. Why not capitalize on this opportunity? Waterloo kids deserve this," unquote. The Central Career Center campus is the site currently being examined for the new high school at the district's western edge. It is anticipated that grades 10 through 12 will occupy the new high school, with a projected enrollment of 1,980 students. This would rank among the 10 largest high schools in the state, behind the likes of Des Moines Lincoln, which is 2,350, Linmar, 2,250, and West Des Moines Valley at 2,050. Preliminary plans suggest the current East and West High School buildings would house students in grades 8 through 9. Bunger, Carver, and Hoover Middle Schools would be the district's home for students in grades 6 and 7, with Central Middle School students relocating to the appropriate building based on grade level. Elementary schools would remain in the same facilities. During this exploratory process is where we can take a look at things like air conditioning and what else do we need to do to invest to ensure 8th and 9th graders are getting the quality education that they deserve, said Emily Frederick, the district's director of school and community relations. Quote, "Our elementary schools are new. Our middle schools are mostly new," she said. "The oldest section of East High is 105 years old, and West High School is 68 years old. Quote, "This is the logical next step to take a look at our high school facilities," unquote. If the project progresses, construction could commence in 2025, and students would begin using the new high school facility in 2028. District officials estimate the project's scope would make the new high school the largest in state history, ahead of recent builds in Cedar Falls at $113 million, Ames $136.9 million, and Waukee Northwest at $140 million. When complete, district high school students would no longer be required to travel to participate in more than 20 Career Center programs. Quote, to be able to get these offerings in the hands of our students, not just those who are able to flex in and out, said Frederick. If this comes to fruition, we'll be the only high school in Iowa with Career Center right here on campus. Quote, time is of the essence, said Frederick, of why the project was being considered now. We're living in a world of student choice. She noted Cedar Falls is about to open a new high school, and small districts in the region have already opened new buildings. Quote, we lose about 700 kids per year to the open enrollment, and we want to keep those kids. We think that we can educate them best in Waterloo schools, Frederick said. Just point blank, facilities matter, unquote. Along with students, district officials believe the new facilities, program offerings, and reconfiguration will attract teachers and staff. They also say it will now allow Waterloo students to establish a true feeder program for athletics and fine arts, being more competitive. Yes, we are losing kids right now for various reasons, said Smith. We think this will be a major selling point for keeping kids at home, unquote. In terms of the sports rivalries between East and West high schools, Frederick said the athletic directors are incredibly excited about this. The athletic departments are confident that there won't be less opportunity. She said it will also allow the district to build up its performing arts program. The biggest thing is equity. Smith has been meeting with students at East, West, and Expo high schools in recent weeks, and he believes it will be possible to integrate them. Quote, they absolutely agree on the field, on the court, whatever it may be. There's competitiveness there, he said. However, they have told him, we're all friends outside of the competition. We've been hearing from the kids that this is not going to be a major change for them, unquote. He added, quote, we understand that change is difficult, but we believe these changes will make the Waterloo schools a destination district for students, families, and employees. We believe this is a project the community can rally behind, unquote. The board will discuss the project in its meeting on December 11th. Four town hall meetings will be held to gather input from community members. They will be 9 to 11 a.m. on January 20th at Cottrell Elementary School, 6 to 8 p.m. on January 25th at the Waterloo Career Center, 9 to 11 a.m. on January 27th at Poynier Elementary, and a fourth meeting will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. on February 1st, and that location is to be determined yet. For more information and answers to frequently asked questions, go online to waterlooschools.org/bridging-futures. Teenager pleads to reduced charge in August robbery and shooting. Story by Jeff Reinitz. And Dateline is Waterloo. A Waterloo teen has pleaded to charges in an August robbery that erupted in gunfire, leaving one person seriously injured. DeAndre Jermaine Seals entered Alford pleas, not admitting guilt but agreeing a jury could find him guilty if the matter went to trial. To a reduced charge of second-degree robbery, as well as charges of intimidation with a weapon and felon in possession of a firearm, Monday. Sentencing will be at a later date, because Seals was only 17 at the time of the crime. He won't be subject to the mandatory minimum sentence before parole that usually comes with robbery charges. Authorities allege Seals acted as a lookout for Andres Reed, 28, Eric Darnell Hayes, Jr., 17, and others in a plan to rob two people who had arranged to sell guns on Mohawk Street on August 1st. Shooting broke out when the robbers pulled their own guns. Reed suffered a gunshot wound to the head, and the sellers drove off. Reed disappeared while he was being treated at an Iowa City hospital and remains at large. Hayes, Jr. is awaiting trial, which is tentatively set for January. In October, a jury acquitted 30-year-old Larry Earl Larondez Phillips, who was accused of being the getaway driver for the robbers, of all charges. Teen found with stolen gun. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz, Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo teen has been arrested after police found him carrying a stolen gun on Monday night. Officers arrested Jacqueline Tyshawn Thomas, 18, of 842 Kern Street, for carrying weapons, interference with while armed, and fifth-degree theft. Bond was set at $10,000. Police were called to 316 East Mullen Avenue for a disturbance around 10 p.m. Monday. When authorities pulled up, Thomas allegedly began running from officers. Officers tackled Thomas and found a loaded 9mm Glock handgun with an extended magazine in his waistband, according to court records. Authorities traced the pistol and determined it was stolen, court records state. Thomas is awaiting trial for an October 2022 incident where he allegedly broke a girl's jaw, court records state. In June 2023, a Chrysler 200 he was driving was damaged by gunfire. Officers found several bullets in the vehicle, and inside they found 31 spent shell casings, record state. Now we turn the page and find the 20 under 40 column. This one is on Natalie Dlowy, successful banker, busy volunteer, who earns superwoman status. Holly Hudson Hill is our journalist, and the dateline is Hudson. Quote, Natalie Dlowy is the epitome of a superwoman. That was Dana Ollenhop's description of Dlowy when nominating her for 20 under 40 honors. Quote, with four girls under the age of nine, her days and nights are filled with kids' activities, work, and volunteerism, Ollenhop said. And I wouldn't have it any other way, Dlowy said. Dlowy, 37, and her husband Bart are happily settled in Hudson, raising Drew Rizzi, 9, and Carter, Colby, and Collins Dlowy, 5, 3, and 18 months, respectively. Quote, my husband is from here, and I knew I wanted to live in a small town, Dlowy said. We have great neighbors. Dlowy, originally from Denver, Iowa, attended Kirkwood Community College, where she played basketball and softball. She graduated in 2008 from the University of Northern Iowa with a bachelor's degree in finance and real estate. She is now employed at Lincoln Savings Bank as a commercial lender. Quote, we provide loans for startups, business expansions, commercial real estate properties, that type of thing, she said. I walk alongside my customers and help them reach their goals. To be able to help them create something, that's what drives me. It's super rewarding, unquote. Dlowy graduated from IBA Commercial Lending School in 2013 and sits on their advisory board. She joined LSB in 2017 and was awarded the top producer in 2020 and 2021 with the Commercial Lending Department. Through her job, Dlowy was nominated to attend the Cedar Valley Leadership Institute, a months-long program, quote, designed to foster community awareness while developing individual leadership skills, giving leaders a broader view of civic leadership responsibilities and opportunities in the Cedar Valley, Ollenhop said. As part of that program, Dlowy and others supported a fundraiser for Loved Ones Safe Together, LOST, a collaboration between law enforcement and the Alzheimer's Association that assists in locating and identifying individuals suffering Alzheimer's or other medical conditions. Dlowy has discovered numerous ways to parlay her financial expertise into community service. She is a member of Black Hawk Economic Development, the Finance Committee Chair for the YWCA, sits on the City of Hudson Board of Adjustment, and is the treasurer for St. Timothy Church Preschool Board. Quote, with the YWCA, we are primarily dealing with investments, she said. LSB, has a long-term commitment to them. It's all about empowering women. And with the Board of Adjustment, we are working with different ordinances and city policies, she said. I do so much in the Cedar Valley. It's good to be connected with my own community as well. Deloy said there are some people she has encountered during her career who made a real impact on her. Tom Glantz from Farmer State Bank, Teresa Samick from Bank Iowa, and Chris Fischmeyer from LSB. Quote, they really had an impact on me as a commercial lender and helped me shape my lending background and challenge my thinking, she said. Deloy is also a wish granter with Make-A-Wish Iowa. Quote, it is just so rewarding. When you are able to grant a wish, it is just pure joy and excitement. In the summer months, you will spot her on the field coaching two different ball teams, T-ball and third, fourth grade softball, Ollenhope said. Quote, volunteering is so important, she said. Why not use your expertise and plug in and make someone else's day better? LSB is very flexible and encouraging and allows us to be involved. I am grateful to them, unquote. Deloy said she comes by her penchant for community service naturally. Quote, my parents always gave back. They still give back, she said. That has been instilled in me, and it's come full circle. I see my kids now reaching out and helping others. It's amazing just knowing that they recognize what we're doing at home and are now starting to give back in their own way, unquote. UNI to raise West Gym and plan new wrestling facility after region's approval. Andrew Wind wrote this story, and it begins with a photograph showing the old building named West Gym, and we see support columns helping to stabilize the walls of the gym at the University of Northern Iowa. Dateline is Cedar Falls. The University of Northern Iowa is moving forward with raising the West Gym and building a new practice facility for Panther Wrestling Program. The Board of Regents gave formal approval to both requests during its meeting last week at UNI. Costs for demolition and restoring the site to green space are estimated at $1.3 million, or as much as $1.5 million, funded by Treasurer's temporary investments. The practice facility has an estimated cost of $5 million that will be funded by private gifts. The 11,000-square-foot building will be located on what is now a gravel parking lot south of West 27th Street and west of Panther Parkway. Quote, the West Gym has served us since 1925 and served us quite well. However, the building is clearly telling us that it is at the end of its life cycle. Michael Hager, UNI Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations, told the region's Property and Facilities Committee, quote, there are structural issues with how that building was designed and constructed that are presenting themselves today. Most notably, the east and west exterior walls are bowing, separating from the structure, unquote. When that separation was discovered on the exterior of the building this summer, it was immediately closed and steel supports were added to brace the east wall. He explained that the building was constructed as three entities, the gym and two wings. As a result, each part of the structure has shifted at different rates over time, causing the walls to begin to separate. Other related problems, he noted, are that the exterior brick is part of the building structure rather than a facade, and on the interior, sandblasting the painted bricks were decades ago made them susceptible to damage by moisture. Beyond that problem, the building's roof is 1 year away from replacement, and the floor has settled 9 inches as a result of a dance 10 years ago, said Hager. The load on the floor has been restricted since then. In addition, HVAC, central, and electric and window systems are at the end of their life cycles. Quote, if all that work were to be completed, the facility would still need to be updated to meet current code requirements and Americans with Disability Act requirements, he said, not including rebuilding the East Wall. That work is estimated to cost more than $20 million. Hager noted that elements from the West Gym will be preserved during demolition to be incorporated into the new building. While nothing is planned for the West Gym space, he said it would remain a high-value building location in the future. David Harris, UNI's athletic director, said the new building will have a wrestling room, strength and conditioning area, training and locker rooms, and coaches' offices. A modern wrestling facility will not only help us to recruit top-notch athletes, but will also give our current athletes a place to prepare for the kind of competition that they're going to be facing on a regular basis, said Harris. The program has been part of the Big 12 Conference since 2017. The region's approval allows UNI to move forward with the formal planning process led by RDG Planning and Design of Iowa City. And now, friends, we just want to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 22nd, on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. And now, this announcement.
If you're struggling with your mental health, there's something Your Life Iowa wants you to know. It's all right to feel sad, to be angry, to feel depressed, to be anxious, to feel lonely. Something else that's definitely all right? Getting help for your mental health. When you're ready, Your Life Iowa is here for you 24/7. Find support at yourlifeiowa.org. Together, we can make everything all right. Brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial was written by Julie Gamick, who was a former columnist for the Des Moines Register. It's titled, How a Vision is Changing a Community. All In Grocers opened 6 weeks ago in Waterloo, Iowa. It's a new store with an inviting produce section, a local bakery, and Grandma's Hands restaurant, built in an area of the city that had not had one in 50 years. Rodney Anderson is one of the store's visionaries and developers. I interviewed him on October 30th, 2023. Question, where does the story of All In Grocers begin? Answer, you go back to the late 1960s. I think it was 66 to 68. And there was a riot here in Waterloo. And the riot consisted of students at East High, which is predominantly black, wanting the same books and material that kids at West High, predominantly white, had. So on this side of town, which is the northeast side of Waterloo, it was basically burned. And you had businesses that never came back, and homes that were never rebuilt. We didn't have a grocery store, a place to get fresh fruits and vegetables. I like to say that time stood still in this community for 50 years. My daughter and I were riding one day down Franklin Street, and she pointed over at the time this was an old abandoned lot. She was like, quote, Dad, that would be a perfect place for a grocery store, unquote. I said, no way, no way, because I knew it was going to be a challenge. But I didn't know it was going to be a 7-year challenge where we would encounter economic and social racism. Even though we had put our part of the money, the down payments, and our credit was good, we still had those challenges, and we knew that if I and my business partner, Mr. Lance Dunn, couldn't get it done, no one else was going to try to take this on. Question, why a grocery store? I assume there's probably a lot of other things that are missing in the neighborhood as well. Why start with a grocery store? Why groceries? It's food, and everybody needs food. In this area of town, there's only one grocery store, while on the west side of town, there are 8 options. This directly impacts the neighborhoods. A grocery store is just a main staple you need in a community. We call All In Grocers, quote, a community center that just so happens to sell groceries. because the people coming through that door are people you know from church or school, or they work with you. We named it the Miss Willie Mae Wright Community Center for one of our sheroes in this community. Miss White is now 92 years old and has more energy than both of us put together. She's just that kind of a person. And as part of the community center, we will do things here such as diabetes awareness or run a re-entry program for those formerly incarcerated. Informational things to help the community. We also want to use the community center here to address issues in housing, to teach people about how you can buy a house. We want to figure out how we can get together and partner to get land and put affordable housing here, like with a group like Habitat for Humanity. Question: obviously, the struggles didn't end when you opened the door. What are the current struggles? Our current struggle is to get our operations correct. We're not a chain store, so we're doing a lot of things on the fly and learning. But we have our own experience in business to fall back on. I've been in development for 30 years, and I love it. My mentor challenged me each year to do something different for the community. We took down an old, big storage building right down the road that people were using to sell drugs in and built a mall. Now there is a Mexican restaurant and a bakery and a beauty supply shop. Down the street here, less than another half of a block, we also just bought a duplex that is old and dilapidated. But we're going to take that down and make a 4-6-plex for housing. We are continuing to improve our neighborhood. Question: you talked about economic and systemic racism in this project. Tell me about those experiences. Within Waterloo and Cedar Falls, there was not one bank involved in this whole deal. Not one. The only bank in Iowa that put in actual money that directly lent it to us is from Denver, Iowa, called Denver Savings Bank. They are a small bank, but they were just amazed at what we are doing. All of the rest of the financing came from outside of Iowa, from North Carolina, from Milwaukee, and from Madison, Wisconsin, and from Virginia. That tells you a lot. Question: but you obviously have all those other projects going on too? Correct. We have good credit. It's location, location, location. What we found out was the location was great for this community, with the all-in grocers and the mall, which is called Franklin Street Mall. You would think that the bankers, with the experience of living in these towns, would get to know their city. But nothing like that happened. One person said, "Well, we did loan to all-in grocers." No, they didn't. They loaned or donated to a nonprofit, and the nonprofit, in return, lent us money. So now they're making money on a nonprofit, and their risk is down because the nonprofit will pay them if something goes south here. That's not the same thing as lending us money. Question: what would you say to those banks? Get to know the people inside these communities. Get to know the needs of the people, the pulse of the people. It's one thing to tell people, "Hey, sign up and get yourself a bank account here." But to be a part of the community is very different. They could teach about financial literacy and then start loaning to people on this side of town or make gifts on this side of town to build houses and build other services that are needed. This is an underserved and underbanked area. Question: have you seen any impacts from the store yet? This grocery store has been open for only 1 month, but we saw the impact before we even opened the door, because we created jobs. At first, it was the guys and ladies who were building the center, those running the big bulldozers and all the machinery. Now, we have 55 people on staff, so we definitely had an impact. Question: was that difficult? I hear everywhere that people are having a hard time hiring. We had a hard time telling people no, or calling people saying, "Hey, we're going to put you on our waiting list for a job here." I think it was just the kind of job everybody was looking for, and they just poured in, ready to work. Question: how are sales so far? Sales are good. We just got approved for our EBT SNAP benefits last Friday. So our sales have been good without EBT, It's going to pick up 35 to 40% with EBT. Question, are you able to track, I guess visually, who's coming in to shop? When I walked in, I saw a lot of white people. Yes, the white community is using it too, because some of these folks live in the community. That's where I think the bankers got it wrong. They were thinking that this community was just black people. No, we have Chinese, Mexican, every Latinx group. We have everyone here. So, yeah, all the communities definitely use it. And it's going to be even better. We've only been open for a month tomorrow. So the familiarity and the shopping flow are just going to get better. My mom and dad both are deceased. But they always said, I'm going to leave you two things, your name and your character. The name and the character of All In Grocers is to be part of this community. Question, what do you find are the biggest successes thus far? Seeing people's faces light up when things new happen. You know, at first people saw the old building and they thought, oh my goodness, that's an eyesore. And then they see it now and it's like, wow, that looks like it should be on the west side of town. So we have to change the mentality of thinking that you can't see nice things in a predominantly black and brown community. That's the mindset that we're looking for, but it's just going to take time. I have a lot of my white brothers and sisters behind me, supporting me. They invested in this community too. Question, what are your hopes and dreams for what this place can do? My hope is that people continue to support the grocery and that we can also bring in local products. The young woman who runs our restaurant, Grandma's Hands, she is a local chef and came out of retirement to move to Waterloo to do all of Grandma's Hands. The young lady in the bakery department baked her own cakes and she can do all these things. So we want them to bring their products in too, so the community can support them too. But my real dream is to have someone else to do something like this, but better. Because we need services like grocery stores, but we need shoe stores and other businesses. And I want someone to come in with a farming system where we can farm year-round in the greenhouses and have even better vegetables than our already great produce section. I also want to buy straight from farmers and take their products straight to those shelves over there. I've reached out to a couple of people. That's one thing I told the architect when he was doing this design. I told him I wanted to walk into the store and feel like I'm not on the side of town with a median income is $25,000 to $40,000. I want to see it like it's $800,000 plus with great produce and a bakery. Question, is produce selling like other products? Yes, produce is selling. You know, people are very thankful because the first thing, we don't have a small produce section. Normally, a lot of folks are underbanked, underserved people in these areas, and they rely on gas stations. So when they go to the gas station, they can only get horrible food, nothing healthy. Now they can. Before Hillary Clinton, there was Rosalind Carter. This editorial comes from the New York Times, written by Azada Moaveni. When Americans look back and take stock of their most impressive first ladies, they rarely think of Rosalind Carter. In a 2020 poll that asked historians and other experts to rank first ladies on a score of exemplary characteristics, Mrs. Carter came in ninth, trailing Dolly Madison, Betty Ford, and Jackie Kennedy. When Apple TV Plus produced First Ladies, a series of six documentary portraits in 2020, it ignored Mrs. Carter entirely. So did Showtime's 2022 drama series, The First Lady. Both, again, featured Mrs. Ford, who only served a partial term, and whose primary contribution to the White House history was her candid persona. While Mrs. Ford's personal charm and willingness to confront Republican pieties made her a star, she made no lasting change to the institution of the East Wing itself. The only way to understand the First Lady entertainment complex's posthumous preference for Mrs. Ford over Mrs. Carter is that she is the First Lady equivalent of Princess Diana, a glamorous, tragic figure whose personal agonies produce riveting television. Mrs. Carter, cheerful, stable, staid, makes for less compelling drama, but much better lessons in wielding power from that singular office. We are in the midst of a reevaluation of the Carter presidency, long considered a failure, prompted in part by a celebrated 2021 biography that declared Mr. Carter the most misunderstood president of the last century. But his first lady, so far, has merited no second look. Perhaps on the occasion of her death, it is finally time to give Mrs. Carter her due. Only two first ladies in the 20th century can claim to have transformed the institution. Eleanor Roosevelt shaped America's highest expectations of a first lady, but it was Rosalind Carter who built a fully staffed office of the first lady to match her activist ambitions, creating a power base not just for herself, but for all of her successors. Serving as an equal partner to her husband, the president, advancing a mental health policy agenda, brokering peace between Israel and Egypt, these were high aspirations. Mrs. Carter had the canny instincts to know that a player who courts influence requires a court. She hired a seasoned Washington journalist as press secretary, set up a separate office led by a highly trained advisor, the director of projects, to handle policy, and brought on a chief of staff to oversee it all. She assembled a highly competent team and moved the First Lady's personal office from the residence to the East Wing itself to join them. Mrs. Carter's charismatic press secretary, Mary Hoyt, led the fight for the decent East Wing salaries, despite stiff opposition. If Mrs. Carter wanted staffers capable of preparing her to testify before Congress and lead a diplomatic tour across Latin America, discussing hard policy with government leaders, the White House would need to pay them in accordance with their experience. But it was a time of austerity. President Carter was demanding sacrifice from all Americans and turning down the heat in the White House to cut costs. Mrs. Hoyt wore cashmere mittens while typing to keep her fingers from freezing. So many Americans wrote in to complain about the office's staff members getting paid anything at all that Ms. Hoyt prepared a form letter in response. With Mrs. Carter's backing, she managed to get raises for herself and for most of her colleagues, and also extracted a reserved parking spot next to the vice president's as a perk. Up until the Ford administration, East Wing staff members had been chauffeured to work in a government town car, a little privilege that softened the paltry pay. This remunerated, professionalized, sizable office of the First Lady that Mrs. Carter established helped her pursue her agenda. It also created the model for the modern East Wing as an office with the stature and capacity to wield profound influence as an arena for setting policy, shaping the presidency, and shifting cultural attitudes. At the time, though, Mrs. Carter's achievements were largely dismissed. Late 70s press coverage mocked her as Rosie Rosalind, a dour Southern Baptist who canceled hard liquor, dancing, and French cooking at White House dinners, all seen as not elegant or remnants of Kennedy-era decadence, and allowed her staffers to shuffle around in clogs. Feminists like Gloria Steinem faulted Mrs. Carter for not being sufficiently outre in her activism. Quote, "I am disappointed in her altogether," complained Ms. Steinem in 1978. Even women reporters like United Press International's Helen Thomas, an old White House hand who had witnessed far lazier and media-hostile first ladies, were unimpressed. Quote, "There's no ferment, no mystique," she wrote. "She creates neither love nor hate," unquote. Neither America nor Washington was quite ready for Mrs. Carter at that time. A careless classism and Georgetown-set pettiness ran through much of the D.C.-focused society gossip and political reporting about her. Nancy Reagan was careful to cultivate the Katharine Graham-led Washington social elite to preempt the same fate. While Mrs. Carter was less contentious of politics than her husband, and strategic enough to know that lofty goals required politicking, she, too, came from a small town in Georgia and had a slightly defensive air of humble superiority. It kept her from doing the image crafting and social brokering that first ladyhood requires. It was only a political outsider like Andy Warhol who visited the Carters in Plains, Georgia, to do a portrait of Mr. Carter after he won the Democratic nomination, who could appreciate her steel. Quote, "She's the tough one, Rosalind," he told a colleague after the trip. Quote, "She wears the pantsuit, polyester," unquote. Less Washington-centric press accounts from Mrs. Carter's time in office acknowledged that she had managed to achieve, but with an undercurrent of ambivalence. A Newsweek columnist referred to her as Mrs. President. On the occasion of one speech, a piece in The Atlantic described her as having, quote, "the air of a child at her first piano recital." It was only years later that mental health would emerge as a national health crisis, and by that time, Mrs. Carter's early efforts to both forge a care agenda and combat stigma were largely forgotten. The legacy of the Carter administration itself was neglected for decades, and only recently has generated renewed interest. My own interest in Rosalind Carter was piqued in childhood, when in Iranian emigre circles, her husband was blamed for haranguing the Shah of Iran on his human rights record, emboldering the anti-Shah Iranian student movement in the United States, and thus shepherding that great disaster, the Iranian Revolution of 1979. In my mind, the name Jimmy Carter, pronounced in a Persian accent, still sounds like a cuss word. When I grew up, became a journalist, and investigated Mr. Carter's efforts to end the Iranian hostage crisis, I was startled to learn that Mrs. Carter's position amid the turmoil had been hawkish. She had advocated mining the harbors of the Persian Gulf and cutting Iran's oil exports to U.S. allies. Ultimately, she knew that acting judiciously would cost her husband a second term. Quote, "Jimmy could have blown up Tehran and been reelected," she wrote in her memoir of the night of his electoral defeat. Quote, "Yes, I was bitter, and so was everyone else in the room, but I was the only one who admitted it. Mr. Carter rejected her counsel, but Mrs. Carter's directness about wanting to win badly enough to have pushed for confrontation gets to the very heart of her gritty political instincts. In the obituaries published this week, Mrs. Carter's consequence and her singular role in creating the modern East Wing are finally being recognized. For a young generation that seems to scarcely remember her, but does register Eleanor Roosevelt, it matters to know that Hillary Clinton was not the only other strong activist first lady of the last century. The received wisdom of the Clinton East Wing is that any ambitious first lady risks provoking a devastating backlash. But Rosalind Carter and her aides ran a powerhouse at a time when women's political participation in formal politics was just emerging. If she wasn't beloved, she also wasn't deeply polarizing. More important than any measure of popularity, she managed to achieve her key goals. Any parallels between the two women are necessarily imprecise. They came into office at different times, under different circumstances, with different marriages and different personalities. But remembering Mrs. Carter's legacy is important because what it illustrates is simply possibility. Any narrative of what a modern first lady can or can't be that leaves her out is incomplete. Next, Reynolds seeks further tax cuts for Iowans. Story written by Caleb McCullough, and the dateline is Des Moines. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Monday she was in talks with legislative and industry leaders about further reducing Iowa's income tax rates in the upcoming legislative session. Reynolds promised another round of income tax cuts when she announced in September that the state ended the fiscal year with a $1.83 billion budget surplus. Speaking with reporters on Monday, Reynolds said she wants to make sure any tax reductions put in place will be sustainable in the long term. Quote, "We're spending a lot of time looking at the environment, watching what's happening with inflation, and the impact that it's having on our businesses in the state of Iowa," she said. Reynolds pointed to the surplus and the Taxpayer Relief Fund, a separate fund that ended last year with $2.74 billion, as evidence that Iowa is collecting too much in taxes. Quote, "We've got money there, and we're going to turn it back to Iowans, and we need to be more competitive," she said. Reynolds and Republican leaders passed a tax overhaul in 2022 that set individual income taxes on a path to a flat 3.9% in 2026. Corporate income taxes will fall to a flat 5.5% by 2028 if revenue from corporate taxes hits certain benchmarks each year. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 22nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.